भद्रं कर्णे विश्वनुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यचक्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सुष्ठुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
We are on verse 4 of the Vaitatya Prakarana, the second chapter.
Antasthanat tu bhedanam, tasmat jagarite smritam, tasmat jagarite smritam, yata tatra tata swapne. यथा तत्र तथा स्वप्ने संवृतत्वेन भिद्यते संवृतत्वेन भिद्यते अन्तस्थानात् तु भेदानां तस्मात् जागरिते स्मृतं यथा तत्र तथा स्वप्ने संवृतत्वेन भिद्यते.
This verse is making a logical syllogism and making an initial statement which the rest of the chapter is going to unfold and prove and establish. Okay. It starts out with, just to give you a breakdown of the words, antasthana, fifth case, because of being inside. Remember when we were talking about the swapna, about the dream, the mityatva of the dream was really established for two major reasons. One is the dream is taking place inside, right? And there's not enough room in there. It's taking inside of your head. So antasthana, it's taking in, it's inside of your body, inside of the nadis. And samvritatvena, there's not enough room in there. It's compressed. And so it can't really be happening. That's one of the reasons. The other is taking place inside. Then if you do a logical extension in that, when you're dreaming about a given place, and say you find yourself in that place, say I have a dream about India and I'm going to the temple in India, I don't wake up there at the temple. I wake up here. And also, I might be dreaming of chariots and elephants, which is the example they use. I might be dreaming of really big things. Those things can't fit inside of me. And if I actually, so they can't fit inside of me, that's an obvious thing. And also, if I am dreaming of India and I wake up here, say I was dreaming of India, first of all, I wake up here, not in India. And another thing is the people that I'm just talking with are not going to be able to acknowledge that they saw me. Oh, that was a nice time that we had at the temple, it was a beautiful puja. Nobody's going to be able to say that to me. So it's all what we call subjective reality. The point, though, here is that why they talk about this, they're telling you the obvious. Because we don't have a problem with the mityatva, that the so-called falsity or non-real nature, the non-real nature of the dream. That's very important that we don't have that problem. And since we don't have a problem with the mityatva of the dream can become easily a drishtanta for us, for a logical syllogism. Drishtanta is the example that is used to support the piece of logic. Because say you're giving a piece of logic and you have no example for that anywhere in the world. Then why should it be true in this case? There's no drishtanta for it. There's no place to apply it. That means it's just coming up in your imagination. So you have to have some, for a logical syllogism, you have to have some sort of relationship that's called an invariable concomitance. It's just an invariable relationship between two things. But for there to be an invariable relationship between two things, you have to have already established that relationship somewhere, right? That's why they say, like in a logical syllogism, or in the Indian version of it, with the smoke and fire, they'll say like this: There's fire on the hill. Why? That's the pratigna. There is fire on the hill. That's the initial statement that needs to be proven. Why do you say there's fire on the hill? Because I see the smoke. Then the next thing comes, because I see the smoke. That's the reason. Then you have to show the invariable relationship, which would go something like this. Wherever there is smoke, if it's really smoke, not fog, something else, but wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Though you wouldn't say, wherever there is fire, there is smoke. That's a problem, because not all smoke has fire. But if you're seeing smoke, there has to be fire there. So where there is smoke, there is fire. But then how do you know? Do you have any examples for that? To make that? How can you make that type of invariable relationship? How do you even know about it? Right? So then they'll say, like in the kitchen. Because in India they're cooking over the fire, like in the kitchen. You see that smoke and fire go together. So that's what they call their drishtanta, just like in the kitchen. You experience it over and over again. There's smoke, there's fire. So we can then extend that relationship to just seeing the smoke. So if you can say, because of your experience, you can say wherever the smoke is, there's fire. Then if you see smoke, you can infer fire. So this is all, if you've ever had these logic classes, and if you're in India studying, you'll get all of this type of thing. But here, because in Gaudapada's Karika, he's using logic, trying to use logic to establish what the Shruti says from the stand for the Shruti as a pramana. The Shruti as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, is putting forth these things with a certain unfoldment. Now he wants to go through and show it logically. Okay? And so here, just a little precursor here, he's saying now, this is a little hard to read, so I'm going to have to do it in a different order to make any sense out of it. I'll have to go to use the words in the way that they are, because otherwise I can't do it. It goes like this, the second line, yata tatra tata swapne. That's going to read like yata tatra swapne. Just as there in the dream. So yata tatra swapne, just as there in the dream. Tata, similarly it is understood. So you go like this. You have to put in words. Just as there in the dream, similarly. Similarly what? Here. Mm-hmm. So he says, so you take it like this. Tasmat. Okay, this is for the Sanskrit people. Tasmat, yata tatra swapne, tata. Is tasmat, therefore, just as there in the dream, similarly, jagrite smritam. Similarly, it is understood to be so, smritam, in the waking. So just as there's that vaitatya, the mityatva, which has been previously established in the first few verses, just as there is mitya, and you accept the mitya in the dream, similarly, it is to be understood that in the same way that vaitatya, which is understood here, is there in this waking state. That's the pratigna. Just as in the dream, similarly here. This waking state is false. This waking state is false just as the dream is false. Vaitatya means mitya. This waking state, this jagrita sthana, is false just like the dream state is false. Right? Now he says, antastanat tu bhedanam samvrtatvena vidyate. There is a difference, though. In the dream state, it is vidyate. It differs. Because of being compressed in your brain, in the nadis, in the dream state, and because of being inside, because of these two things. This is one way to take it, okay? This is a little complicated verse, so it's not complicated really, but the Sanskrit's a little bit complicated, and And then when you read the commentary, Shankara does it in a very different way, taking some assumptions. So anyway, we have to just work with it, and let me try to make it clear. Beda-nam here, this word beda-nam, it means of all of the different things, beda means different. So when I look out in the world here, I see all of these different things. So all of these different things, the bedas, which are seen, all of these things are vaitatya. All of the things that I experience here are false. Right? Why are they false? Well, for the dream, you can say, well, the dream, the mityatva, is, well, because they're inside. Now, if you have to remember that, they're antasthana, they're inside, so they're false. But an objector comes by and says, that's not enough to make them false, because this cup is inside this room, and that doesn't make it false. Just because something's inside doesn't make it false. It says, no, it's not just that. It's because it's inside, and the inside space is inappropriate. It's too small. You know, you can't put an elephant inside. Maybe this cup could fit inside. You can't put an elephant inside. And then again, you know, there's also not enough time. These are the verses that we did last week. There's not enough time. You know, when you dream, you can cover vast distances in a small amount of time. And there's not, in real life here, it's not, you're not able to do that. And so these things belong to the dream, really. They don't belong to the waking state. You know, I don't have a problem of having to fit in my perceptions. Except in this way, there is a problem with it. And this is sticking to Gaudapada. I'm going to go into Shankara in a minute. This antasthanat, there is a problem in the waking state. And the problem is this, that I'm not actually perceiving anything out here. Everything that I perceive is actually a vritti in my mind. I talked about this a little bit last week. So in that sense, whether it's the waking state or the dream state, both are antasthana. Both are taking place inside. So look at the mechanics here. We if you have to remember back to the last week a little bit, but I'm going to do it again because it's so profound, actually. When I'm experiencing this waking state, it's very clear to me. I don't really apply any logic. It's very clear to me that I'm here and this world that is being perceived is out here. That's very clear. I don't think about it until we start analyzing it. And when we analyze it, we realize that actually what is taking place is that through my sense perception, my mind, using my sense organs, an antakarana vritti, a thought modification, takes place in my mind, which is then illumined by awareness. So actually, whether it's in the waking state or in the dream state, both are equally experienced inside. Right? And so the inside space is also too small. That inside space is also too small for both. Okay? But that's taking a standpoint which is going to be established in a different way as we go throughout the chapter. But it's an interesting, from just taking what Gaudapada is saying, you know, he's saying that you can take it like this. Swamiji worked with this in some different ways, and Shankara works with it differently. And Swamiji works with it as Shankara works with it, and also as Gaudapada works with this. You can say like this. Because of being inside, antasthanat, for all of these things that we perceive, right, just as there in the dream, similarly it is the same here in the waking, because both are being perceived inside, because it's an antakarana vritti. Okay? For all bedas, for all the duality that we experience, all of that duality is being experienced in the mind. And we have the Drikdrisha Viveka comes to support that. The Drikdrisha Viveka makes you understand that, okay, I see this world with my sense organs, but my mind sees my sense organs. You also understand that if I'm perceiving, if my sense organs are all open, totally present to the room, like all of you are seated here in the room with all of your sense organs available, but your mind could be daydreaming. And if your mind is daydreaming, there's no perception taking place. And so what you actually must be perceiving at any given time is whatever is going on in your mind. If you're daydreaming, that's what you're perceiving. If you're remembering something lost in thought, that's what you're perceiving. If you're using your sense organs, that's what you're perceiving. And so whatever perception that you're having is taking place in your mind, which is not as big as the room. Your mind is here. It's in your brain, in your nadis. That's the example. You're using your brain, you know, through light. This is all coming in, and that's your experience. So your actual experience that you're having, whether it be the dream state or the waking state, has got to be mithya, has got to be false. That's one way, that's how Gaudapada says it, takes it. Then he says, then you would take that vidyate, it differs in terms of the samvrtatvena. Because when you're dreaming, we can think in this waking state that here's this external world, and I'm a jiva walking through it, so this external world has what we call vyavahara. It has an empirical reality. But we're walking through it. In your dream, you know that it's a subjective reality. And you know that that subjective reality can't be real compared to this reality. And so that becomes clear. That gives the special mityatva standing to the dream. And that same thing doesn't necessarily give a mityatva standing to the waking state. But what is similar? And this is where Shankara elaborates. What Shankara will say is because of you using the word bedanam, means all of these things. For all of these things, there's vaitatya. For all of the things, there's mithya. All of these bedas. How do we even know that there are bedas? How do we know that there are different things here? Because they are all perceived. So that means that everything, and this is in common to the waking state and the dream state, every single thing that we perceive is mithya. So the pratignya is this, the full pratignya, the full logical syllogism is this. Everything in the waking state is mithya. Why? Drishyatvat, because of being perceived. Just like in the dream. You can use the antasthana, the being inside and being too small of a space to just apply to the dream if you want to. Or you can take the antasthana because of being inside for the waking state and the dream state. But what they have in common is that they are perceived. And so this is actually what's going to be established in this whole chapter, is that everything that you experience, this whole waking state, is mithya because it is perceived. Whatever is perceived is mithya. And that's a huge statement. If you perceive it, it's mithya. That's what's being said. And so this Sanskrit here is complicated, and so Shankara just broke it down. And I'm going to go through the commentary for you, just in kind of a, I'll do it in a translated way with a little bit of Sanskrit in translation, just so that you can, I don't know if it's too much for you, but I kind of want you to become familiar with some of these words. He goes like this, Jagrat drishyanam bhavanam vaitatyam. Vaitatyam means mithya. For all bhavas, for all things that exist, that's a bhava. Anything that exists is a bhava. Anything that's come into being is a bhava. So for all things, jagrat drishyanam, which are seen in the waking state. So for all things that are seen, or that are experienced in the waking state, drishya means seen, experienced. Seen, don't let seen stop. You would have to say seen, heard, touched. So you can use experience. Anything experienced in the waking state, right? Whatever it is, any existent thing here that we experience in the waking state, that is mithya. That is vaitatya. She is iti pratignya. This is the initial statement of the syllogism. This is what the syllogism is. It's a logical. What do you call a syllogism? It's just a logical
proof.
It's a logical proof. It's like a rift, you know. This is because of this, because mm-hmm. of this, because of this. Therefore, this is the truth. Mm-hmm. So the pratignya is always the first thing that you need, is the statement that you're going to prove. And so here, the pratignya, the first statement of any given syllogism, is that all these things which are experienced in the waking state, they are mitya, they are vaitatyam. So then he says, what is the hetu? So we've got the first statement, the pratignya. What is the hetu? What is the reason? What is the reason that all these things that are seen in the waking state, what is the hetu? Drishyatvat, because of being seen. All of the things experienced in the waking state are mitya. Why? What's the hetu? What is the reason? Drishyatvat, because of being seen. Right? And then he says, now he has to give what's called the drishtanta. So this is the third term. We've got the pratignya, the initial statement. Right? We've got the hetu, the reason. And then we have to have a drishtanta, an example. So here's the drishtanta. Swapna drishya bhavavat. That vat means like. An example is going to be, you know, like such and such. So here the drishtanta is like the bhavas, the things, which are drishya in the swapna. Swapna drishya bhavavat. So just like things, the things that are experienced in the dream. Right? So now what do we have? The pratignya. All these things that you experience in the waking state are mitya. Why? Because they are seen like in the dream state. Okay, that's the drishtanta. And then he goes to the verse and he says, yata tatra swapne, just like there in the dream state, drishanam bhavanam vaitatyam, just like there in the dream state, there is the mityatva, the vaitatyam, the falsity of all objects, of all bhavas, drishanam, which are seen, tata, similarly, jagarite api, similarly here, in the waking state, also, drishitvam, because of being seen, avishishtam iti, because of being seen, which is the same, right? There is no difference because of being seen. The drishitvam is identical in both. So he says, so just as there in the waking state, there is falseness, vaitatya, mitya, for all of the objects that are being experienced. Similarly, the state of being seen in the waking state is identical. This is called the upanayana. It's a repetition of the hetu. It's a full repetition of the hetu, of the cause. So because these two are the same, he says, tasmat, therefore, jagarite api vaitatyam smritam. Therefore, it is understood, it is to be accepted, smritam, that the vaitatyam, the mityatva, is there in the dream, in the waking state also. So that is the syllogism. And then he says, this is Shankara, he says, antastanat samvritatvenacha swapnadrishanam bhavanam jagrat drishyebhyah bedaha. The difference between the two, the waking state and the dream state, between these two, has to do only with, in the dream state, the experience is taking place inside. So Shankara is doing it, the whole thing is differently. The experience is taking inside, and it's too small in there. It's an inadequate space. That's the difference between the waking and the dream, because what Shankara wants to make you to reiterate is the waking state is different than the dream state. It is different. The waking state is what we call pratibhasika. It's subjective experience. The dream state is vyavahara. It's an empirical experience. Did I say it wrong? Mm-hmm. The waking state is vyavahara. It's empirical, right? It's shared reality. The dream state is subjective. But that's true. In the dream state, you know, it's taking place in your inside of your mind, and it's an inadequate space. And also there's not enough time and all of these things. That makes it different. It makes it a subjective that we call pratibhasika. That's the dream state. The waking state is vyavahara. It's an empirical. So there's a difference between the two. But both are mithya. Why are they both mithya? You know that the dream is mithya. You're clear on that. But we're saying that we're using the mithyatva of the dream state as a drishtanta, as the drishtanta for the mityatva of the waking state. What do the two have in common? They have to have something in common, or you can't use the dream state as a drishtanta and illustration for the waking state. So what they have in common is drishyatvam, the state of being seen. And so now what we have to be able to accept now is this. We have to now be able to say, if this is the hetu, drishyatvam is the hetu for the mithyatva. Whatever is seen is mithya. You have to be able to accept that because that's what's being said. Anything that is seen is mithya. Anything. Whether it's being the waking state or the dream state, anything objectified, you know, that is known, is mithya. And so that is where this particular verse leads us. The whole rest of the chapter has to really establish this. Now, after Swamiji did this, like I just did with you, going over the Bhasha, and seeing what Shankara is doing with it, he went back and looked at it exactly what Gaudapada said, because Gaudapada did not bring in the word drishya because of being seen. But, and neither does the Mandukya Upanishad. It doesn't use the word, that word drishya. But that it is drishya is understood. Because the instant that you say, you know, for all of these differences, beda nam, for all of the, beda nam is in the genitive plural. Beda means a difference, a division. So beda nam means for all of these divisions, means all of the different bhavas, all of the different experiences that we have, all of the things that we see. Whenever we open our eyes or our ears, there is a multiplicity of experience. But that multiplicity of experience requires me, the subject. And so this is true in the dream state also. Subject-object differentiation. And so, whenever there is subject-object differentiation, there is drik-drishya. Drik means the seer, drishya means the seen. That's why, in the teaching methodology of Vedanta, the drik-drishya-viveka is kind of the bread-and-butter differentiation that... Swamiji doesn't always start with that now, but usually when you're teaching, it's... The drik drishya viveka means seer-seen differentiation. That teaching methodology is one that we very often start with. Because as you go through that seer-seen differentiation, what you had taken to be the seer becomes the seen, along with the seen. For instance, if I say, I'm aware of this room, this is the scene, and I, this body-mind-sense organs person, am the seer. This is the drik, this is the drishya, right? So all of these things are known by me through my sense organs. And then you go in one step, you just have to say one thing here. Yes, all of these things are known by you, you're the drik, the seer. All of these things are known through your sense organs, and they become the drishya, the seen. That is true. But what you're not realizing is that the same five sense organs are aware of your body. Without your sense organs, you wouldn't be aware of your physical body. And so, and then Swamiji will go in great detail, having you remove one sense organ at a time. And as you remove one sense organ at a time, the world disappears as well as your physical body disappears. But once you realize that, now the sense organs become the drik, and this becomes the drisha. Right? This is now belongs to goes in into the creation. You go one step in, and now the manas, the mind, is the one who uses the sense organs as instruments. If the mind is daydreaming, the sense organs aren't functioning. And so the mind is interior to the sense organs and are aware not only of what the sense organs see, but they're aware of the sense organs and how they're functioning. Now the mind becomes the drik, the seer. And the sense organs become the drisha. So the sense organs have now joined the world. And now you say, well, what about the mind itself? It also is known. You're aware of all your thoughts, you're aware of all your feelings. You know, when you do Vipassana, you sit there and just let those thoughts all pass. Or any type of meditation, they're just passing through. All of them are known. They're all coming and going. They're all actually drisha. And so now, this what happens is in this analysis, even then you can do the ahankara, the I notion is just a thought. That's also become something you're aware of. It's drisha. So now what happens to you is that now when you think of the world and the seer seeing differentiation in the world, the seer now belongs to the world. The seer is part of the drisha, right? Because all of it is objectified. So the subject-object seer-seeing relationship that had seen, subject-object relationship that had seemed so real, now every part of the seer has become the seen. And now when that happens, now we have another situation. When every part of the seer has become objectified to be the seen, then we have the situation of both the seer and the seen existing in one conscious being, in awareness. Right? Because of awareness, I'm aware of the seer, and because of awareness, I'm aware of the seen. And so now the awareness becomes the luminary of the duality which I'm experiencing. And so now the subject-object duality has joined the creation, and awareness has been liberated from it, so to speak. Awareness becomes that in which everything is. Then we have to go in and analyze these drishas. And now the drisha is not only what I perceive through my sense organs, but this body, mind, sense organs, everything no longer belongs to the Atma, but belongs to the creation. And so when we say, see what's happening here, when you say drisha is mitya, the only thing that is not drisha, that is not objectifiable as an object, is the Atma. So, and the only thing that is free from time and space and free from change is that which cannot be objectified, doesn't exist in time and space. Okay? Yourself isn't subject to change because it's not an object within time and space. Only things within time and space are subject to change. I mean, just it's a no-brainer. Something has to be subject to time to change, just like time. It has to be subject to time to change, right? Time has to, for time to have any function at all, you know, it has to exist within duality. Because where could there be change? If there's no duality, there's no change. So time itself depends upon space for objectification, for duality. So we say, for change to take place, for time to take place, you need duality. So space, air, fire, water, earth, you know, time and space. Time and space. Space, air, fire, water, earth, and then you obtain, and you put in time. Time is just in relation to change. You know? And then you have this world of experience. If consciousness were to be an object within this world of experience, then it would also be changing. It would be a thing. But the one thing you can't, the one and only thing you can't objectify is consciousness. Consciousness also doesn't need to be objectified because it's consciousness. If you say consciousness needs to be objectified to be known, then who's going to know it? Right? You can't have a subject. The buck stops there at conscious being. Everything else is objectified and everything else comes and goes. And then in the Mandukya Upanishad, we went to the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state. Each one of these states negates the other. When the dream state is not the waking, when the dream state is, the waking state is not. When the deep sleep state is, the waking state is not there, the dream state is not there in your experience. So these experiences are all negating each other. The waker has already been given to the waking state. The dreamer has been consumed by the dream state, and the waking state, everybody's in a manifest condition, right? Mm-hmm. So the waker belongs to the waking state, the dreamer belongs to the dream state as part and parcel of it, and the waking and the deep state, they're all collapsed. So now when we look at these different types of teaching methodologies, so now going back to the Drishta Viveka, what you're continually left with is that the body, mind, sense organs that you thought was the drik belong to the drisha. And what is left is me. Non-objectifiable consciousness. Non-objectifiable me, consciousness, is satyam. Satyam means it's not subject to change. If it were subject to change, it is mithya. If it were subject to change, that means that whatever it is at this moment, it wasn't at the prior moment. Anything subject to change. What it is right now, it wasn't a moment ago. It's changed. So that means, if that's the case, what is a moment ago no longer exists. And where did this thing come from? Right? Did this thing come from non-existence? Is it going to go? So there's a huge, huge type of logic that's taking place here around the nature of change. About the nature of change is the prior non-existence of a prior moment and the posterior non-existence of a given moment. Right. I don't know if you're following, but maybe I'm talking too fast here. We've done this a lot of times, though. Let me just do it really quick so you see. Use the clay pot. We use a lump of clay. If I make a lump of clay into a pot, okay, 3 seconds ago there was no pot. There was only clay. I squash the clay and now I flatten it out and I make it into a plate. Now there is no, at all, there's no pot. There never was really a pot. Actually, there never really was a pot because the pot had no prior condition and it has no posterior condition. And nothing can come out of nothing. So you have to go to what is actually there to get to the satyam. What is actually there is the clay. That's real. In reference to what is actually there is clay. Pot depends upon the clay, therefore pot is mithya. So this clay pot example, starting with a lump and going to the pot, this is the reality of anything that changes. It comes from the condition that it comes into being from a condition of where it was not before. And so something has to allow for that. There has to be an underlying reality that allows for that phenomena to take place. And whatever that is called satyam. Whatever is called mithya is that which depends upon the satyam, right? For it to be. Like the pot can't come into being without the clay. You know, it has no prior condition. It is, and the clay is not becoming. The clay just simply is. And so here what's being said is anything that is seen, anything that is experienced, is mithya. Because every single thing that is experienced, that is objectifiable, everything without exception, whether it be the waking state or the dream state, or any mental state, it doesn't make any difference. Right? Every single thing is subject to change within manifest creation. you think you are the seer, the seer-seen relationship. Well, actually, as you analyze the seer-seen relationship, everything about the seer also becomes mithya because it also is seen. You start here. I am the seer of this creation. I am the seer of this waking state. Then you have to say, yes, but the one who's the seer of the waking state is also seen, is also illumined. Right? Otherwise, you have to say, I'm not aware of my body. And I'm also not aware of my sense organs. And I'm not also not aware of my mind. No, well, I'm also not aware of the I thought. I'm not aware of my memories. And that's all not true. All of these things are drisha. Right? They're all seen. It means they all exist with it to be seen. They all exist within duality. They're all subject to change. And so they're all mithya. Anything that is objectifiable, mithya. And so this is what the whole Mandukya is saying. Shankara just boiled it down to this word, drishyatvat. He boiled it down to that. Because that's actually everything that is being said here. And if you look at, you use the dream as a drishtanta, which we do, and which is used in the Mandukya Upanishad, the dream also is seen. This is what the two have absolutely in common. One is pratibhasika, one is pratibhasika, subjective reality, one is vyavahara, objective reality. But the drishyatvam, the fact of being seen for both of them, is absolutely the same. And so then, we're going to do this next verse real quickly, because it's just a statement that wraps this up.
스왑나 자가리타스타네 예컴 아후르마니시나하 예컴 아후르마니시나하 베다남 히사마트웨나 프라시드헤나에바헤투나 스왑나 자가리타스타네 He, ekam, ahuhu, manishinaha, bedanam hi samatvena, prasiddhena eva hituna. He says, the manishinaha, ahuhu, the people who really know, the rishis, the wise people, the people who have knowledge. These manishinahas, what do they say? They ahuhu, they say that the swapna, the dream state, the swapna sthana, and the jagarita sthana, that these two sthanas are one, are the same. The dream state, the waking state, and they're the same in terms of vaitatyam. Right? So the manishinaha, the wise people, ahuhu, they say that the dream state, the swapna sthana, and the jagarita sthana, the waking state, both are the same. Why? Bedanam hi samatvena prasiddhenaiva hetuna. He says, he means because of the sameness of all of the things that are seen. Bedas means of all of these different things, of all of the things, the bedas, all of the differing experiences, the vishayas, means the objects of experience, all the different objects of experience, they enjoy the same, the samatva. What is the samatva? What is the sameness? The sameness is the drishyatva. All of them are being perceived. And so he says here in the Bhasha, and then he says, prasiddhena eva hetuna, by this very well-known fact, by this very well-known, prasiddha means this, it's by this accepted, by this accepted reason, this reason that everybody knows, right? by this, and what is it? The samatva, the sameness of the Vedas, of the differences that are being experienced, of the duality that's being experienced. So in the commentaries, just as a little paragraph here, he says, prasiddhena eva bedanam grahya grahakatvena hetuna samatvena. He says,
Because of this well-known similarity between the perceiver and the perceived of all of these Vedas, there's the perceiver and the perceived among all of these things that are being experienced. This is prasiddha. This is something that is very well known. And so he says, because of this, the swapna jagarita stana yoho ekatvam, the one, there is oneness between the dream state and the waking state. Ahuhu vivekinaha, those who have viveka, means those who, viveka means this discriminative knowledge, the manishinaha, the vivekinaha. These who have this viveka, they understand, they say that there is the oneness between these two states. Iti purva pramana siddhasya eva palam. He says this is trying to establish what has been said earlier by the pramana. Pramana is the Mandukya Upanishad, and so he's just gotten us to this point. Now he has to prove it. He's really told you is what is the, that this whole world is mithya. Because it's seen, you know, and that's what the Upanishad says. He's established the mityatva of the swapna. He's saying the swapna, you'll see that the swapna and the waking state, the dream and the waking state, they're the same because both are perceived. They're both being perceived. You know that the dream is, you know that the dream is mitya. The dream is the drishtanta, the illustration for the logical syllogism that's going to prove that this world is mitya because it's seen. Okay? I gave you a little bit more as I was unfolding this, but now we have to go through verse by verse and see how he establishes the truth of it. And what this chapter 2 does is establish beyond anything your brain can handle the mityatva, means anything your brain will can try to refute it, but then another verse comes and just knocks you over again. And then you try to, you know, grab onto something, but then the next verse is there to knock you off. So what he has to establish logically, what the Upanishad has already established, is that this whole creation that you experience is mitya. It's mitya. It has no more reality than the dream. You can say, from the standpoint of satyam, from the standpoint of Brahman itself, it has no more reality. Swapna and jag, and the swapna, the dream and the waking state are the same in terms of their mityatva. If you're looking at the dream from the standpoint of the waking state, you can say, yeah, but this has an empirical reality and the dream is only subjective. We accept that completely. But that doesn't make one mitya and the other not. It makes the mitya of the dream pratibhasika, subjective mitya, but it doesn't make the vyavaharaka, the empirical reality that we experience, not mitya. You know? In fact, it only supports the mityatva of this creation. And the only satyam that is there is the one that is finally the adhishtana for both mityas. Right? The adhishtana, for something to be mitya, it must have an adhishtana. It must have something, it must be based on something real. Right? Otherwise, the word mitya doesn't even apply. Right? So mitya must have a satyam. The satyam is its adhishtana, is the very thing that allows it to be. So the satyam of the dream is atma, is the self. The satyam of the waking state is atma, is the self which is Brahman. That's the adhishtana. That is what is actually here. All of this is only mitya, means it has for its reality. It's not dissing it at all. Mm-hmm. It's just giving it the level of reality that belongs to it. It's not saying that mitya is good or bad.
Or
more or less. It's saying it's mitya. Yeah. When we're talking about Advaita means one without a second. There's only one thing here. But we're experiencing a multiplicity. So what is the one thing which this multiplicity is? That's not saying the multiplicity is bad or less. These kind of things don't apply. Less than what? It's actually a miracle that Brahman, that consciousness, has Maya as its incidental attribute, and expresses in as this infinite creation. And that this infinite creation is nothing but Brahman. This infinite creation is Brahman. It is infinite consciousness. That means that all of this, and now this is where really the Shruti Pramana comes in. You can say all of this is infinite consciousness. But that the whole infinite creation is Ishvara means that just like if you have a, this is why that understanding the dream or your imagination is so important. If you have an imagination, like say if I ask you to imagine a meadow, okay, when you have that imagination, that's the Maya, comes into meadow manifestation. If I ask you now, imagine a meadow, that comes into meadow, the meadow is there, boom, there it is. That meadow is known. You are the self, the Atma, the conscious being of the meadow. And the meadow is known, right? Any thought you have, the thought comes into manifestation, it is known. So when I say you are the Ishvara of the imagination, or you are the Ishvara of the dream, okay, or of the fantasy, that means that that fantasy comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves back into you. The fantasy is known. The thought is known. The imagination is known. The dream is known. That's the nature of Maya, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is the reflective principle that is pervasive to whatever the vritti is. So now, when you're talking about Ishvara, we're talking about a total vritti, an infinite vritti. We don't use the word vritti, really. But the whole Maya Upadhi, when the whole creation comes into manifestation, it is known. It is known. That's what makes it Ishvara, not just Mother Nature. From its own standpoint, it's inert. There's no such thing as inert. The sattva is pervasive to the Maya Upadhi. Right? And so the whole Maya Upadhi is known by who? The conscious being, really? The conscious being, which from the standpoint of that, illumines it. So if we go about and say, well, is consciousness a knower? No. It's just consciousness. But because the entire creation is known, we call the consciousness as the Sakshi, even though it's not doing anything. It's the Sakshi because it's because of, and Sakshi translates as witness, and then you say, oh, it's a knower. But it's not really a knower. It is consciousness, and the whole creation is known because of that consciousness. But consciousness isn't doing anything to know the creation. It's just that the entire creation is known because it's there. Your mind is known because it's there. Your thoughts are known because they're there. And they have for their adhishtana consciousness. Consciousness, the word consciousness, we use known as a synonym for consciousness. When you know, we have know or known. But the knownness is the luminosity, is the self-evident nature of consciousness. So when the whole creation is manifest, that entire creation is known. Now, who's included in that creation? Everybody, everything. Absolutely everything that exists in duality, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the thoughts, the moods, the emotions, the ahankara, the I-notion, your memories, everything that exists within duality, right? That is part of the Maya Upadhi. And everything within that manifestation is subject to continual change, therefore mithya. How to know what's mithya and what's satyam? Well, what is mithya is what can be seen. Anything that can be objectified. Anything that can be objectified is drishya. If it can be objectified, it exists within duality. It's part of Maya. Right? And so then it has no independent being. It has being. It has absolute being. But that absolute being, the Satyam, is not subject to change or coming and going. It can't be objectified. Anything objectified exists within duality. Atma, your being, can't be objectified. It doesn't break down into a subject-object relationship. Right? It just simply is me, self-evident me. So now as you start to understand this and kind of look at the internal territory of your experience, you're not doing anything. You are everything that matters. You're the only thing that matters, really. And you are always the same. And because of you, everything is known. Actually, everything is you, just like the pot is the clay. Yeah. But you need to recognize yourself, differentiate yourself from all of the experiences that enjoy you completely. All experience that you have enjoys you completely. You give it its being and its knownness. But from your own standpoint, you're always exactly the same. You're always the very being of all experience. And that's why as you start to understand this, all the experiences that you have, especially the bad ones, you can just resolve into yourself. Just relax and say it's okay. Just bring it home. Those experiences are mithya. They don't have any substance, really. You have the substance. So I'm talking about all these emotional, mental experiences. You can just relax them and just bring them home. And once you know that you're there, once you've recognized yourself, there's no distance between the experience and you. And so you're not far away to bring yourself home to it. just relax. So it'll be okay. Just relax. And just recognize your own, the fullness of your own being. That is a huge awakening, or whatever word you want to use, is to recognize that why they say that you are Ananda, or that you are the beloved. You know, like Rumi and some of the poets will say, you are the beloved, or you are Ananda. And then you'll say, I'm not Ananda. I really have a long ways to go before I mature into being able to own this experience of being Ananda. That's what people think. And that's not true. It takes you a long time to realize that that's not true. But what you have to realize, though, is that the Ananda, the belovedness, the wholeness that they're talking about, is your very being that is here right now. That is the very most important thing. It's just you've defined it by these bliss experiences, you know, Ananda translated as bliss, and all of these profound spiritual experiences. I think because Jesus walked on water, that's one reason. You know, that you have all these miracles and all of these big, big highfalutin ideas of what this bliss experience or enlightenment is supposed to be. And that hides, it like puts like hides you the truth of the Ananda that's being talked about, which is just the very dear nature of yourself. So that's why in meditation it has to do, like we're doing some japa now and things, just to try to get the mind just to quieten down and just realize your own presence. And you quieten your mind down, you're not trying to have an experience, you're just trying to relax a little bit just to realize who's here. And then you ask yourself something like, why do they say I'm Ananda, this me that's here? You have to ask yourself about that. And then you can say, you can ask yourself questions like, is there anything else more dear than me, more meaningful, more important than my own being? Those are really important questions to ask and to really think it through and try to imagine something that means more to you. You can't do it. It's impossible, actually. But that's why it's important to ask the question.
It forces you.
Yeah, it forces you. Is there anything more dear? You think it sounds narcissistic or something, mm-hmm. You know, and that can make you poo-poo it. But you know what? It is not narcissistic at all, because it's the nature of reality. That innermost being is Ishvara. That innermost being is Brahman, is Bhagavan. And that's why there is nothing more dear. We think that that self belongs to the body, mind, sense organs, and me. And so how narcissistic of me to think that this innermost being is most dear. But the thing is, this innermost being is most dear. This innermost being is Brahman. The innermost being is the very self of Ishvara. My being is Ishvara. Right? The self that I am is the self which Ishvara is. So we're going into the realm of Advaita. It's not me or you. It's just me. Just the one me. Just the one self, which is the self of Ishvara. And that is the most dear. And it is not a bliss experience that comes and goes. Experiences come and go. It's your very being, your very nature, which is the self of all beings, actually. And that nature is the most dear. And so we have to get rid of all of this, these extreme states, and just settle down to being with what is actually here, that I don't have to go into some sort of an altered state to experience. You have to get rid of all of that type of thinking. And then just settle down and just be with what is the most simple thing that there could possibly be. That's the problem, you know. When Swamiji was teaching, when I was first with Swamiji, and he was doing so many classes, and finally something dawned on me that I still hadn't understood, but it dawned on me. I said something. I said, you know, Swamiji, this is really simple, isn't it? I didn't even know the profundity of what I was saying, but and he said, this is exactly the problem. It is so simple that we have to unwind and unwind and unwind and unwind, because it's right here. As it's my very being, it's me. You know. But then we have me is so identified with the body and the mind and the sense organs, and we've had, you know, highfalutin type bliss experiences and all of this. All of that has to be unwound so I can be with what is the absolutely the most obvious. And I still remember when I realized it, I was shocked. I was totally shocked. And the shock went like this. It's me. That was I had those words in my mind. It's me. And that sounds so kind of ridiculous, doesn't it? But and why should that be such a shock? Well, because that's the last thing you think it is. Because you're already here. And you've already been here. You know? You've always been here. You've already been here. You are you. You already take yourself to be you. It's already who you are. So it's an amazing thing. It's just you realize that you, who you are, who you always have been, are actually free of all these appendages, that all this baggage that you had identified you with. But it's still the very same you. And there's nothing more free or beautiful or whole than that. It's an amazing, amazing recognition. But we have to keep unwinding, unwinding, unwinding till we get to the most simple, obvious thing that there is. Even in Shankara, in the Brahma Sutras that Swamiji just started now, his Adhyasa Bhasha, Shankara's Adhyasa Bhasha is the initial introduction to the Brahma Sutras. And in the very beginning of the first paragraph, Shankara says something like, it is impossible that one can mistake, you know, conscious being for what is not conscious. That you can mistake the subject from the object. It's as impossible as mistaking light from dark and darkness. It is impossible, but here we are. And then he goes on in his commentary, the first, something like that. He says it better than I did. But he goes on in his three or four page commentary to do this whole Vedanta. in this adhyasa bhasha, adhyasa means superimposition, the superimposition born of ajnanam, that it's caused by, he says, it's caused by very natural, beginningless ignorance. There's nothing that you can do, it's not your fault, it's beginningless. It's absolutely natural. But this ignorance, what is so incredible about ignorance, it has all of this capacity to cause all of this adhyasa. But ignorance is the one thing that is beginningless but can come to an end. That is the magic of ignorance. It's beginningless, but it can come to an end. Can't have a prior condition because its prior condition would be knowledge, right? But so this beginningless ignorance that we suffer from, causing this impossible situation that nobody in their right mind could admit is even possible, is here, this adhyasa. But its solution is jnana. This very beautiful commentary. Okay. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. Before I forget to remind everybody, I'll have class this Thursday, and then I'll be going, and I'm leaving, and I'll be back. Not on the 30th, I'm coming back in the night sometime, so that's a Sunday. So it'll be the next Thursday after the 30th that we start up class again. I'll send out an email. So I'll have class Thursday, and then gone for 2 weeks.
So we won't be here next weekend.
Okay. Yeah. I'll be here Thursday, but not...
not Saturday or Sunday?
No. Not Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
What are we supposed to do?
Study.
In these commentaries, and especially in the Mandukya, but I think in all of them, there's such an emphasis on these logical arguments
yeah.
for certain things.
Yeah.
Like to an extreme, sometimes.
Yes. That's manana. It's because of manana.
I feel like I have a kind of a fundamental question about if there in Vedanta there are teachings that can't be proved by logic alone, that you have to use these texts as a pramana to actually understand that you can't just use logic.
Mm-hmm.
Then why such a reliance on logic?
Because... for something to really be understood, we say there's three components for you to really grasp the mind, for the mind to be satisfied, which I think is really important because people want to dismiss the need to think or the need to understand, but the mind needs to understand. The mind is the one that's ignorant. The mind is the one that needs knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. So we say there's three components, Shruti or Pramana. Say because the Vedanta accepts the Shruti as a Pramana. So Shruti, Yukti is logical. So you must have a pramana for it. It should be able to withstand. So think of it like this. Logical, it should withstand logical inquiry. That means that your mind can say, yeah, but what about this? Or why couldn't it be like that? So that whatever the pramana is, it needs to be able to withstand logic and to withstand your experience. It should mesh with your experience. But say there's some logical whatever And you can't relate to it at all. There's nothing in your experience to substantiate that. So you need all three. And then for the mind to really be satisfied. What's beautiful about this is not just a Vedanta, but in India in general, in the darshana, whole darshana system, in the Indian mind, you are encouraged to think, to inquire, to try to shake. They used to have drishtantas for it, to shake the post. Mm-hmm. You know, they have an example for gaining what they call nishta. Nishta means where there's a firmness, a clarity in your knowledge, an understanding. It can't be shaken. And they use the example of a post, putting a post in a post hole, and how at first the post is all wobbly, you know, but then as you pack the dirt in all around it, and tighter and tighter and tighter, that post becomes strong, you know. And so your mind, you know, has to pack the post so that it becomes strong, and it packs the post by thinking, you know, by inquiring, by not being afraid to question. And that's why when we say that pramana is this threefold, what is really the, it's called the upayanishta. What is the means for gaining this knowledge? We have two, upayanishta and upayanishta. Upayanishta is the gaining the quality of mind necessary through karma yoga to gain the antakarana shuddhi and all these things, to gain a mind that's available. The upaya is the thing that has to be gained, to be known. What is the nishta for that? What is the means for that? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana includes, though, the logic. Shravana is like this. What does the Upanishad actually say? And then you can question that. Well, does it say this or does it say that? Does it say tetramasi or atetramasi? Mm-hmm. You are that or you're not that? What does the Sanskrit really say? What is the tatparya? What is the actual vision that the Upanishads are holding? And there's all kinds of different tools for analyzing that. It's called the shadlingas, all of these things. So that's the shravana. But then there's the manana, which says, so then your mind comes in. Now you've understood, you know, this is really what the Upanishad says. But then your mind goes, yeah, but why does it have to be that way? These are where all the darshanas are useful. Because each darshana, even if you can't think of, you may not be able to think of any objections to why couldn't it be this way or that way, other than what the Upanishad says, the darshanas will do that all for you. They'll come up with, you know, like there's many purushas in the prakriti, the maya is absolutely real. That's what we call a purvapaksha. Mm-hmm. You could as well be thinking that. Like why is there only one Atma? You know? Why is this Mithya? Those are important questions. That's manana. So that every doubt about the vision that the Shruti has to give, every single doubt is being dealt with. Nididhyasana is to remove, it's a meditation meant to remove the Dehatma Buddhi. The Dehatma Buddhi is the conviction, Buddhi, the conviction that the Atma, the self, is the body, Deha. Dehatma Buddhi. Deha, Atma, Buddhi, right? The conviction that the Atma is the Deha, the body, subtle body or physical body. Dehatma Buddhi. Right? And so that's kind of just so natural. We've spent, you know, beginningless lifetimes with that identification. And so you can be gaining this knowledge, clear, but your mind is still falling into that self-identification. And so by meditation and just having your mind get to recognize yourself rather than be yourself, right? That requires some viveka, discrimination. This nididhyasana is something that is practiced. You know, so the shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So the yukti is to convince your mind. You know, and not to, I don't mean to convince your, the mind is smart, you know. You can't fake it. You know.
It's so contrary to Western culture.
Oh, totally.
It's like, it's such a different way of learning. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's actually in the West.
Well, it's not understood in the West, I would say. But I think that I've the experience I've had even teaching at CIS is that students are very excited and kind of energized to learn that it's really okay to think. That it is okay to use your mind, that it is okay to question anything spiritual or religious, because we're really not supposed to do that.
You're one of the only teachers that that tolerates it to the level that you do.
I know.
There.
But that's why they're so excited about
yeah.
it. But I'm the only one that tolerates it because I'm the only one that's been exposed to that
right.
tradition
yeah.
right.
that allows us to do that. So you learn how to think, you have to breathe, it's all right to question. There aren't any sacred cows, you know?
Well, there are in India.
But I guess then, if there are parts that you have to take on faith, and then there are lots that you can prove through logic.
You know what, that's also, you have to understand, if you say, now, take on faith, let's just look at that. There are things like reincarnation.
Yeah.
That there are many lokas, many different worlds. Punya and Papa, Dharma, all of these things. When you get to Punya and Papa and Dharma, say if you get to Dharma, that becomes very experiential actually. But that there's Punya and Papa that goes with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you have to believe that. You don't have to believe it, but it's going to be a belief, or we can say an indirect knowledge. If you accept the Vedas as Pramana, that's an indirect knowledge. It's not a direct knowledge. Okay? But with the vision of Vedanta, it is a very aparocha. It's a very direct knowledge. And now the only thing is the recognition that you can't have the Ishvara Swarupa. You can't have that vision. But by logical extension, when you understand the rest of it, there's really no other way that it can be. And so you can't say that that's indirect knowledge, like in the same way that the rituals that we do will take you to Swarga Loka. And that's faith-based. So you have to be careful. You know, like you can say that the first part of the Vedas, what we call the Karmakanda, the whole first part, that you have to have Shraddha in the Vedas to accept that. Why would you do all of these pujas and rituals and think that, you know, the smoke is carrying all of the, on a subtle level, is carrying the mantras up to the devatas, and that the creation is all connected together by these laws, and all of these things are blessing you, and that this is only one birth of many, and all. That's a whole vision that is held in the Upanishads, held in the Vedas, and the Upanishads are encased in that vision. Right? And so as you gain the vision of Vedanta, which is aparoksha, means it's going to give you direct, immediate knowledge because you are here, this creation is here, what they say is mitya, that is here to be experienced on every level. What is satyam is here to be recognized. So that's going to be aparoksha. But the same Upanishads that are giving this knowledge are part of the whole Vedic culture, and are referring back and forth. You know, they refer back and forth. And so when you gain this knowledge, the Vedic culture that contains it works well.
Yeah.
You know, not that you have to become an Indian and wear tilak and all this kind of stuff. You don't have to do any, you know. You don't have to chant or all of these things. That's all, you know, that's all very, very cultural. You may like it, like I love all of that. Because I spent so many years in India and it suits me. You know? But it's not that I sit around chanting all day either.
So would you say that the Vedanta is independent of the cultural container?
The knowledge of Vedanta is independent of the culture, just like gravity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law of gravity. It doesn't belong to India or to the States. Science doesn't belong to the States, even though they may have excelled in it, or the West may have excelled at science at one time, and it's slipping quickly. But, You know, but that doesn't mean that the same laws of science don't apply to the rest of the world. And so this vision also, it doesn't belong to the Indians. It belongs to human beings. But it's held in the Indian culture. Now, when we talk about something like the ongoing nature of the soul, reincarnation, 63% of the world just accepts reincarnation, 66 or 63. This is breathing, you know. It's only a much smaller percentage has this kind of Judeo-Christian, I'll just say Christian. The Jews have a lot of different things they say about it. But, you know, heaven, hell, purgatory, and all of this. They had different ideas in the 3rd century. They had some ideas of
reincarnation. Well, so are the Muslims.
Yeah.
Say,
but they're just different, you know.
So you can't logically prove reincarnation and say that you, I mean, you could take everything else and that gives you a lot to work with.
Yeah, but say you say you can't logically prove reincarnation, which I can accept that, except that I think everything points to it. Hmm. So many things point to it that it's not very hard to accept, but I don't see logically proving it. Even the information that you would think might prove it, that's all anecdotal. Mm-hmm. And so in science, we don't use anecdotal information to really prove something. But there's so many experiences that people have, you know, that speak to it.
I think it's only, and I agree with you, but I also think that because there's so much emphasis on logically proving things, it feels like those things that I can't do that to feel kind of weak to me, in my understanding. And I feel like something like reincarnation is really so important to the vision, because if, for instance, that weren't the case, then this is my only, you know, this body is really my only chance at liberation, because of what
we come out. In that way it's important, because you think, well, I think that is, even if you weren't a mamukshu, you know, I think that's really important, and it causes huge stress to all the jivas that believe this is their only time. This is your only time here. So you have to pack everything in, and you're not going to fulfill all. Like, I remember when my grandfather was on his deathbed, you know, and he just said, and he said it was so much hurt, you know. So many, he was a historian. So many books I didn't get to read. You're serious. He had a huge library of history books. There was still so much he wanted to read, you know. Because you only have this, you know, this one time here. And so that's a very, very pressing. In the East, they don't have that pressure. They can actually participate in their life because they just know that it's one of many, you know. So they're born within that container.
So there's that advantage to believing in reincarnation, but isn't it true that even if you don't accept any of that stuff, that requires only belief and doesn't have yukti and anubhava, that even though reincarnation may have anubhava, that you can still...
You can still have this vision with satya mitya.
There might be a little more stress to deal with, but there might be other advantages.
Yeah. The thing is, that's fine. And I know Westerners have this, they need to do this. They a lot of them, they just want to be able to prove everything that they believe in, as though you can prove everything. And you can't really prove everything that you experience. But when you get rid of punya and papa, you know, and dharma and its relationship to punya and papa, and you get rid of reincarnation, right? And then if you get rid of all of these things, then really there's no subtle world. You get rid of the subtle world, you know. You also get
well,
rid of...
still dreams and thoughts.
No, the subtle world on a collective level, okay? You get rid of that, then you have some problems. If you still believe in a God, then it doesn't make any sense. It's very hard to give a reason for the inequality of experience, and And Christian theologians have this problem. You know, you can read on. There's a lot written about this, like how to make sense of God. And some of the Jewish theologians, rabbis, what are you called, Jewish theologians? Anyway, Jewish theologians, because of the Holocaust, some of them, I actually have a whole binder on this.
Talmudic scholars. Talmudic scholars.
Yeah. Yeah, but what they were, these people were saying, you know, if there is a God, in reference to the Holocaust, these were papers that rabbis had written on the Holocaust. If there is a God, you know, then who wants him? In reference to the Holocaust. There is a God?
He saved us.
Who wants a God like that? You know? So you can, so that's a very sensible thing to say.
Theodicy, it's the issue of the call, right?
Yeah, theodicy. Yeah. The nature of God.
And the nature of the existence of evil and theodicy.
I don't remember.
How can things happen to good people?
All of that, like that, yeah. So all of these type of things come up that you can't answer. And so when you kind of look at what the Vedas have to say, everything works for you on an emotional level. Just, you know. So you can say that doesn't matter, but when you start thinking about it, these things actually do matter. Do you want to be held by something that works, and no matter how much your mind thinks about it, it just keeps working more? Or do you want to be held by something that doesn't work at all? And the more you think about it, the more horrific it gets. You know? So you kind of have that choice. And since the vision that the Vedanta has to give, which is aparoksha, which is direct and immediate, that vision supports all of these other things. So you can say, well, you can't prove it, but I can't prove it. I don't feel like I can prove it. And I don't feel also like with reincarnation and all of the different levels and how all of that works, I can't prove that all either. And so I can't know it, even feel that I know it, in the same way that I have this vision. But I accept it, even though I don't know it in the same way. And I don't even know that it's true in the same way. I don't know it in the same way, and I don't know that it's true in the same way. But it resonates with me, and I accept it. And I think there, for me, there's also kind of, we'll see, you know? But it all makes sense to me in light of this vision.
Right, but also in the vision, all of that is mithya.
It's all mithya. So it doesn't really matter. But the thing is, the one who is getting liberated is mithya. The mind is mithya.
Right.
The mind needs to have
the yukti is
mithya. You need a container that you feel that you can relax in. You can't relax into a container that you don't even believe in. That's not an option. That's just somebody else's thing. But what is your containing myth? You have this knowledge, and then how does the mithya work? How does the creation work? You need to be comfortable in it to whatever degree you need to be. You know what I mean?
If you look at the history of religions, there's some cultural adaptation that happens when spiritual tradition or whatever you want to call it moves to a new location. There's always some kind of cultural adaptation, and there's got to be something here if Vedanta is going to survive, because not everyone is going to be able to go to India and immerse themselves, and you know it's not going to happen like your experience. And there's got to be some way that it seems Vedanta is going to need to change to accommodate Western culture if it's going to survive.
Well, I don't think it needs to survive.
I mean, not the Vedanta, not the central part of it, but the locus, I don't know that that's necessarily going to last 100 years from now if we look at who's teaching Vedanta in this country, you know?
Well, I don't know. I don't really think of it like that. I don't feel that Vedanta, as it's taught in India, has to continue to be taught here. I think Vedanta will be taught to mumukshus wherever they are, and that Vedanta is something that it's kind of not a man-made thing, that there's a lot of Ishwara involved in that, you know, and what the people would have given mumukshu needs that student will get. I feel like that. I don't personally feel any responsibility for, I feel a responsibility for teaching Vedanta as I've been taught it, you know, and that's what I do to the very best of my ability, really. And I want to teach everything that I've been taught in the way that I've been taught it. And then for some people, that may be too Indian or something, but then I'm not their teacher. Mm-hmm. I'm not the right person for them. They need a person who has translated into maybe in ways that are more palatable for the Western mind, and hopefully in a way, for a certain Western mind, and hopefully in a way where the vision as it is retained. Mm-hmm. The purity of it is retained. You know, I would rather teach, personally, I'd rather teach the whole thing and then let people get rid of what they want. But I want to give the whole thing as I've been given it, you know. And that's just me. Somebody else might want to give it in a different way and kind of, you know, leave some things out. And that's what they will do. But hopefully, the core of this vision, it will be given completely enough that a person's mind has what they need to be free. You know?
Yeah, I did, just to be clear, I didn't mean that as a criticism.
Oh, no, I know, but it's an issue.
For someone like me, there are certain hurdles that in accepting certain beliefs that just realistically they're not going to happen. I'd hate to think that I'm foreclosed from, you know, pursuing this further, that it's a worthless enterprise if I'm, you know, not going to buy some of the things that are dependent on solely belief.
If they're dependent solely on belief, I don't think it matters. I do think that Ishwara matters. And we can go into in depth why that is. Because if Ishwara is not understood, and I don't mean like some sort of a man in the sky, that's not Ishwara. I'm not also talking about personification of deities. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about that. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about this totality being Advaita, non-dual, conscious being, so that the entire universe is known. Because if you don't understand that, there's going to be something missing. And there's also something going on in your mind which has a God complex. Mm-hmm. The God complex brought about by the West. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's just a negative word that you don't want to have anything to do with. Which, for whatever reasons, there's a lot of concepts around God, you know, that you, most of us, have dismissed in many different ways a long time ago. And the word itself doesn't resonate well. I'm speaking personally, I don't even like to say the word God because it doesn't resonate well with me. It doesn't bring up things that are meaningful to me or that I like. It's actually a negative word, unfortunately. That might not be true for all of you, but for me it is. Ishwara is not. Bhagawan is not, because if I say Ishwara, then that, what Ishwara is very positive, because it's filled with that knowledge. But if I say God, it doesn't sit well with me, the word, you know. Maybe because of my upbringing, I never did believe in any of that. You know? I believed that there was a God, but not that one.
16
chapter. Yeah. You know, so. but a lot of Westerners will ask Swamiji, to understand this, to gain this knowledge, do I have to believe in God and all of that, you know? And Swamiji used to just say, no, no. Meaning, you know, because it's valid to say that, actually. Say if you were to say that to me and I just said, no, you don't have to. I can say that. And I can really mean it because, because what I'm really saying is, no, you don't have to. You don't have to believe in the God you don't have to believe in that God. The God that you think, you know, what you mean by that word. But to think that, to have your mind be so closed off to understanding what is meant by Ishwara, I think that's a problem. I think you have to look at the reasons your mind is closed off to that understanding. And we can do a lot of unfoldment about, I can go on and on about all the reasons the mind is closed off to that understanding. But this is all part of the inquiry. Say if the Vedanta is saying something like that and you say, I'm not going to believe that, right? Then we have to look at why. What is the resistance there? What is just emotional or some baggage that you're carrying? And what is realistic? And whether maybe there's a very good reason for it. Or maybe you aren't really understanding what the Vedanta is saying. So we have to just, you know, be free to inquire. You have to be free to inquire into everything.
Yeah. While I was at the ashram, Swamiji was talking about the Sampradaya. He said that even if all of India burned down, that the teaching would still be alive in Berkeley.
That's so great. It's true.
That's so true.
He said it to the whole lecture hall, and I don't think that everybody really even understood what he was talking about, and I just like sat up straight.
That's Swamiji. See, he probably said that for you. Yeah, he probably did.
No, it's true.
It's true.
It is true.
It is true. Yeah. It is true. Yeah. I'm glad it's true too.
Us too.
Yeah.
We're
a little oasis here.
Doing the minus 10, the minus
Oh, 10. Swamiji came up with that. That in doing japa, you do these relaxing the body and letting your mind get rid of whatever it's baggage and do a little inner child work just to relax, you know, and to bring the mind, relax the mind. And then you do this addition because, and subtraction, because only the buddhi, the deeper mind, is capable of that. And so when you're doing that, this fluctuating mind can't operate it. You can't do it. You can't multitask when you're doing addition and subtraction. You know? And so you do that, and then where that's taking place, you just stick the mantra there. Mm-hmm. Okay? You don't have to stick the mantra there, but that's what he says.
Do you try and get an answer to all those
additions? Yeah, like, yeah, you do it. You have to do it. And then just listen to me do it.
Yeah.
And then if you're doing it and you lose track, you lose count, you just pick up from where. It clears out the mind.
But you don't give the right answer at the end.
I try to.
Actually,
I
think you did.
Today,
yeah, I was
actually
really impressed. I was like, that's really impressive.
But I don't always get there.
Yeah, no,
today
it was
I
really
did.
Impressive.
Yeah, I got back,
like,
yeah.
But you know, he
just get back to zero.
Yeah. You know,
I try to end up back at zero, but sometimes I get lost. I just start, you know.
With the aging mind, though, if there's doubt about whether you're following it, isn't that the fluctuating mind coming back
yeah.
in? So it's
yeah.
like both happening at the same time.
Yes.
That's right, but oh, I'm not. Right.
Yeah, so don't worry. All you do is just let yourself do that exercise. Don't worry if it's coming out right, because it probably won't come out right, because most of the time it doesn't for me. Because I can't remember, I forget in the middle. And, oh, where was I?
I think my interpretation of that was that's the sthanam where the mantra takes place. And so when I lose, or you know, I'm not sure, it gets kind of dull, I go back to the subtraction to find that kind of really like center of the buddhi, and I do the mantra there. I mean,
that's
that was
nice,
my interpretation
yeah.
of that.
That's
of
right.
That.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. But in doing it, you know, you can find it because the manas is cleared out. It can't operate at that time. So it's just like a trick.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a nice little discovery.
It's a nice little discovery, yeah. He was so proud of himself.
Yeah.
Pretty revolutionary.
Yeah, it's really...
He said one of the greatest things, every teacher has something that they offer. Besides for Swamiji, the very obvious one was so much emphasis on Vedanta as a pramana, which is there, it's throughout the whole Shastra, but it's not always taught in that way. So he makes that very, very clear. And the other is Nididhyasana, his guided meditations. He's really developed guided meditation to just so profoundly beautiful.